It was also surprising. Denise was getting a free oil change at her dealership. That's surprising in itself, isn't it? Free oil change at her dealership in White Rock. Although Denise drives the humble Camry, this dealership has the reputation of selling more expensive Toyota vehicles to Chinese immigrants than any dealership in Canada. So Denise sat down at a bar stool at some large bay windows. She wanted to read her book. She opened her book, but she noticed a woman wearing a big floppy hat, another strange thing, sitting a few stools down from her. And she appeared to be weeping. Now, I can understand crying in a car dealership. I get that. But this seemed different to her. So she went over and asked, great question, by the way, not how are you doing, when it's pretty obvious she's not doing well. She said, what has happened? The woman turned her tear-stained face towards her and in a thick Chinese accent said, my da ha cancer. Okay, so Denise thought, she said, your daughter has cancer? No, my dog, she said. It just kept getting stranger. Then the next surprise, she reached out to grasp Denise's hand and held on to it tightly for 5 minutes. As Denise related the aftermath of the conversation, the context, the issue, and the response, it became clear that the Holy Spirit was really involved somehow. She was greatly comforted. There are surprises in these scriptures today. If we imagine the New Testament ones as a series of matryoshka dolls, you know those Russian dolls, they nest one within the other, it might be helpful. Especially since Mark's already doing something like that, enclosing one story inside the two bookends of another. Scholars call it, no joke, a Markan sandwich. Ironic, because food is already a part of the story, as you know, give her something to eat, are the last words of it. The story that comprises the two outer parts raises as many questions as it answers. Given that most religious leaders had formed a united front, or so we think, against him, what did it cost Jairus, a synagogue official, to ask for Jesus' help? Why are Jesus' Aramaic words, Talitha cum, little girl, get up, recorded, when most of Jesus' words come to us translated into the Greek? Perhaps something about Jesus' tender address to the girl herself could only be captured in the Aramaic, much like Jesus' use of the Aramaic word Abba captures the tension between intimacy and respect in his address of God as Father, better than the Greek word, pater. If so, though, that only serves to raise the emotional temperature of the key question. Granted the knowledge that we have, that there are many children who must have died in Jesus' vicinity during his ministry, why did he do anything about it? Why did he only do anything about it when here and in the town of Nain, mentioned in Luke chapter 7, it was brought to his attention? Now I'm going to allow that question to linger in the background. Nested inside this story, with its power and tenderness, we find our next matryoshka, the surprising story of a woman with the 12-year hemorrhage. Commentators have noted that the years of her struggle tally the same number as the girl's age. Nowhere else in our Gospels is Jesus' power described in such a visceral, physical way. so that he can actually feel and sense the release of energy. Nowhere else is it so clear that faith can sometimes mean simply belief that Jesus has the power to change things for the better, to heal, to free, to open a door long closed. Nowhere else is Jesus' body treated as a kind of talisman, perhaps because touching him was the only option open to this woman in the midst of the surging crowd. We live in a paradoxical world when it comes to touch, don't we? On one hand, we're more informal about it than ever. The first story I shared is a little bit of that. Many of us wouldn't have dreamed of hugging relative strangers at church in an earlier era. But since the 1960s, we've gradually become a more informal, a more comfortable with touch society. Paradoxically, though, we're also a far more wary of touch society. We teach our children the difference between bad touching and good touching. We tell fathers that it's absolutely crucial that they hug their children for proper emotional development. Yet some men I've talked to are deeply concerned, some petrified even, of being accused of abusive behavior if they are seen to be too affectionate. In all of our affirmations and fears about this important behavior, it's important to see how countercultural and brave this woman was. Women didn't simply walk up to men, especially religious leaders, and God forbid, touch them. And yet we see Jesus pictured time and again, not as untouchable, but touchable. He allows a woman to weep at his feet and pour perfume on him. He allows children to sit on his lap. Presumably, he's embracing children not his own. He touches lepers and the ill, and now this woman touches him. We're meant to notice, I think, the sheer power of touch to heal. We're meant to think, I believe, of the sacraments with their physicalness, or of the personal touch in community as potentially powerful and healing. We are called, I think, to be open to touch, to extend the hand to anyone who walks into this building and through our doors. It's okay to ask someone who looks downcast, who is suffering, "Would you like a hug?" Is it risky to touch or to be touched? Absolutely. And some of us will rightly decline if we've been misused or mistouched. But the power of the healing touch of Christ will find a way into our hearts and bodies, or it can. Indeed, this inner story holds out comfort for those of us who've been hurt by authority figures, who've possibly been hurt by the church. It suggests that we can sneak up on Jesus from the back. It suggests that many in our culture might be doing that right now. As an example, I was recently reading an article in the New York Times about the health benefits of fasting. The article made no mention of the Christian tradition. If it had, many people may have stopped reading it right there. But because it was sneaking up on a Christian discipline, a Lenten discipline even, from the back, people could reach out and touch it, embrace it, practice it, share it on email and Twitter and Facebook as some great idea. You see, the Christian worldview isn't dead in our culture. It's just veiled, just facing away from us. We long for its benefits, but many of us can't bear to face it straight on. And this reality, of course, needs to affect how we practice our mission through this faith community. We will find ways And I say that as not if, but we will. We will find ways as a parish and as a wider church to help people know the benefits of Christ before they may be able to name him. Just like this woman. The woman's persistence is equally remarkable. I can't imagine how weak she must have been physically. The story says she's getting worse, getting weaker. And yet her persistence, her determination and cunning are powerful marks of what is possible in faith. Her faith finds a way where no way seems possible. And it is this theme of persistently practiced faith which leads us to uncover the inner Matryoshka, the reading that's inside these other two stories, and helps explain perhaps some of the mysteries we've named at the beginning. Our second reading from 2 Corinthians is one of the most important texts in the New Testament because it explains a central truth of our faith. Initial enthusiasm for Christ is not enough. In almost every worthwhile project, there comes a moment when the initial energy has dissipated. The novelty has worn off, and this is the moment of truth. Through the discipline of recollection, you have to remember your initial passion, the reasons you thought the project was worthwhile and important, and you literally have to be able to put one foot in front of the other. And if you don't, you will again and again know the frustration of half-finished work. You were going to make your garden beautiful, but there it lies out of your back window. A few bushes, a few flowers, but nothing like you imagined. You were going to write something, but the three chapters you managed are in the bottom of a drawer somewhere. That's me, by the way. People often say they're looking for a new challenge or a new faith community, when what they're really saying is they're not prepared to face the real challenge of staying with it, of working through tiredness, sometimes boredom, and completing the job right before them. This is the situation in Corinth. We could probably substitute the name of any parish in their place. Paul has asked them to set aside money every Sunday to fund a gift he is determined to take back to Jerusalem, the mother church, a church now experiencing famine and starvation, a conservative church that thinks his church starts are hopelessly liberal. Paul wants to wake them up to the truth with the generosity of Christ. When the Corinthians had a falling out with Paul, they stopped collecting the money. Now Paul asks, why? Why'd you stop? Let's not leave the job half done. Let's finish it, he says. Parenthetically, this reminds us, doesn't it, that the work of counting the money on Sunday isn't bureaucratic make work, but core and serious work central to the gospel. But Paul wants to say something even more important than don't leave your job half done. Verse 9 contains these justly famous words, "For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for our sakes he has become poor, so that by his poverty you may become rich." One of the most moving descriptions of how God works for our salvation comes in the midst of a passage which is basically saying, finish taking the collection. Collect the money. It's very fitting, isn't it? For abstract theology is one thing, but the details of ordinary human life, with its half-done agendas and subsequent guilt, are retaking up the task, even though we don't have the energy. Personal relations that go sour and have to be reconciled. This is the stuff of salvation. This is the inner message of the story of Jairus and the woman with the hemorrhage. They believe that Jesus wasn't some ordinary authority figure to be placated, to be feared. But in faith, they believe that he was for them, that indeed he was the bearer of God's richness of wellness and nearness, of joy and purpose rediscovered. And they don't just think about this. They act. The first story says he just kept persistently asking. They pursue. They persist. In other words, this is what faith is. And their faith is based on Christ's own faithfulness. Jesus didn't lose heart halfway through his ministry. He fashioned the ultimate poverty, the cross, into the instrument of indescribable riches. Today, that giving, God's and ours, is put to the test. How do you approach this table? Is it without thinking? Just by rote? Sometimes I do. I understand that. But how about tearing a page out of our Roman Catholic brother and sister's liturgy book? Coming with an intention. If I can just touch his cloak, perhaps for physical or emotional healing, for a relationship that is floundering, for a job, for our parish. But as you form your intention, know that God also wants to touch others through you. Think about that as you put money on the plate, and as you determine to live your Christian faith with fresh persistence this next week.